Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
We're going in a Wayback Machine again in NFL history, and we're going to talk about the Minneapolis Marines with a podcaster on the Sports History Network, Ross Bliley of Pigskin Tales, and the Minneapolis Marines, his home team, coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, and welcome once again to the Pigpen. We have our bonus series where we are going back in football history, early pro history, before World War II, the teams that may have been lost to time and somewhat forgotten, but not everybody's forgotten them, especially people that grew up in the towns where they played. And today we have a gentleman who is a fellow podcaster on the Sports History Network, Ross Bliley. He has a podcast called Pigskin Tales, and he is going to tell us about a team from his hometown up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, the Minneapolis Marines. And we'll bring him in right now. Ross Bliley, welcome to the Pigpen.
Hey, thanks for having me on, man.
Oh, we appreciate you coming here. This is an exciting topic to get to talk about the Minneapolis Marines, a very famous team in pro football history that, you know, sort of one of those ones that's been forgotten. But before we get into that, we just want to talk a little bit about Ross Bliley. Now, what makes Ross Bliley a football fan? How did your football fandom start?
Well, that's actually a really good question because, you know, when I first started this back in 2018, I actually had to kind of think of what really did bring me to start watching as much football as I have. And took me a little bit to think about it because I guess I just was one of those people that gravitated to the game. I even had to ask my parents, like, okay, so how young was I when I really got started watching the Vikings? And because the only thing that I can could really remember was in high school while I was playing football for Kindred. And surprisingly enough, my mascot was the Vikings, Kindred Vikings. I think it's one of those things that just about everybody does, right? You always, if you're watching pro football and your closest home team is the Vikings, that's who you just cheer for. I guess my parents were saying that I was maybe like 5 or 6, maybe 7. And I had a really good friend in kindergarten where I would go over to his house all the time, and him and his dad and I would watch the Vikings all the time. But the thing is that I don't remember the mid to late 80s. Even though I was born in 1980, I don't really remember that decade. I remember more of the 90s because that's my teenage years. And I really gravitated towards Chris Carter, especially when my older brother was playing football for Kindred. And my younger brother and I, we'd be on the sidelines and we'd be playing our own football game while their football game was going on. And then, you know, of course, we wanted to be like those guys, Chris Carter, and can't even remember who else was all on that team. There's so many big people, Oh, John Randall. John Randall was always one of those guys that I really liked to watch just because he was so crazy all the time.
Yeah, those are some great NFL players to emulate and to look up to. So you had some real good role models up there. I can see why you got attracted to the sport.
Very right. And then Randy Moss got drafted to the Vikings. Even though he kind of sort of had a bad rep coming from Marshall, you know, with the whole marijuana thing, the fact that he was so good at the wide receiver position and that, you know, him and Chris Carter with Randall Cunningham as the QB, I mean, what wasn't there to love about that offense at that time? I guess I don't even know what else to say about that because it was just so prolific at the time. That's kind of what really got me going. I was one that always wanted to be around people that were watching the Vikings, talking about NFL and stuff like that. But my podcasting didn't start until 3 years ago. I had quit my job at Layton Broadcasting as a DJ there, part-timer, to do fostering. And then I still wanted to be on the radio kind of per se. And my older brother said, well, Ross, why don't you just start a podcast? I guess because I thought I liked football so much and I thought I knew a little something about it. And I really liked the Vikings. So that's kind of where Ross's fan cast was born.
Well, you do a great job of preserving that football history. And I know you've expanded even beyond the Vikings here lately, and they're very enjoyable. I've enjoyed your Red Grange series that you've had on lately. And I think you have some more parts due up on that. So we're excited to hear those. But I guess why we brought you in here today is we want to talk about the team before the Vikings that was in Minnesota in the Twin Cities area. And that is the Minneapolis Marines. And I was wondering, maybe you could tell us sort of how did that Minneapolis Marines franchise form? What's their early beginnings?
Well, from what I could research, that the team started in, or I should say founded in 1905 by two guys. The Marines were owned locally by Minneapolis guys named John Dunn and Val Ness. In fact, the team mainly composed of working class teenagers, which is really kind of interesting because you just don't see or hear of that turning, you know, basically you're right out of high school, going right into college, and then you're playing pro or semi-pro football.
They were sort of probably gracing the sand lots around Minneapolis, playing some pickup games wherever they could there in those early 1900s then, huh?
Right. So the thing is, one thing that's very interesting, I mean, this whole thing was really only around for 20 years. And then, as you know, the National Football League was started by Jim Thorpe in 1920. But from 20 to 25, they really just didn't last very long.
Now's a good time to take a break from our football history discussion and hear from one of our sponsors, Row One Brand. At the Sports History Network, we're all about sports yesteryear, so we're so pleased to introduce you to Row One, an online memorabilia gallery and shop that brings your sports history to life anywhere. The Row One Gallery includes over 5,200 gorgeously reproduced prints of team posters, game program covers, game tickets, advertisements, and more in baseball, pro and college football, pro and college basketball, and more. And any gallery item may be printed in a variety of sizes on wood, metal, canvas, acrylic, or poster paper. And in Row One Shop, check out the thousands more of unique items with a retro and historical designs dating back to 1876, including t-shirts, long sleeve shirts, phone cases, mugs, blankets, pillows, towels, and even shower curtains. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com, ROW number one, for access to the full Row One catalog and for gallery prints and gift items. Plus, get a 15% discount off all prints on the Row One Pictorum Gallery with coupon code SHN15. Follow the link on the show notes.
I think finances dwindled because they couldn't get people to watch, you know, even in those early years, you know, from 05 to 1920, they were a team that was, they were good around the Minneapolis area, but going out of that community, they kind of weren't very good.
Well, that happens to a lot of these early teams. They sort of the king of the hill in their own town. They go out and play some of the bigger squads, you know, they see those Canton Bulldogs and stuff. And that's not the first ones to fall up a little short to them. But what happened after that?
The Minneapolis Marines, when they folded due to finances, not having enough money, then they became the Minneapolis Red Jackets, weren't a winning team, and they couldn't get fans to come in and watch.
How about some of the players that played on these Minneapolis Marines in red jackets. Yeah, and I cheated a little bit here. I was going through some PFRA, the Professional Football Research Association. The Coffin Corner is the publication that they put out. And back in 1998, Jim Quirk put out a real nice article about the Minneapolis Marines. And he talks about their core players that really started coming around in 1907. So that was like the second year that the team was formed, where they had, I guess they played by weight class. So those first 2 years, they played like 115-pound weight class. They moved up to 145-pound weight class, and they added these core players, their halfback and team captain, Johnny Dunn, a quarterback, Rube Ursula, tackle, Walt Big Boy Booland. That sounds like a great name there. An end, Clarence Sheepy Radine, Arthur Dutch Gostad at guard, and a center, Harry Wegfors. And then 2 years later, in 1909, they got a couple more core players. Labe Safro, who was also known as the Jewish Lion. He was a halfback. Mike Palmer was a tackle. Guard, Harold Selvig, and a fullback, Oswald Sunby. That sort of rounded out their lineup for about a decade, 1907 to 1917, until eventually they started paying to their players and traveling outside their local area of Minneapolis. And they went through a roller coaster ride, even having to cease operations in 1918 due to the Spanish flu pandemic. And they soon reassembled in 1919, but they lost some of their key players, who jumped over to play with the Rock Island Independents, one of their rivals. But they still posted a respectable 5-2-1 record in their independent schedule. The loss of those popular core men of like Bobby Marshall and Ursula Booland, Dewey Lyle, and Fred Chicken, it created a decline in attendance numbers, preventing success that the pre-World War I squad had seen in popularity. You know, just that pandemic just really took everything out of them, and losing those players over to one of their rivals just really took some oomph out of it. So the Marines, they were owned by locals Johnny Dunn and Val Ness. They needed a spark to reignite the local interest. So on August 27, 1921, the Minneapolis Marines, they decided to join the American Professional Football Association. And unfortunately, it was a dismal APFA NFL experience. The thought to generate revenue and interest backfired as the team posted a 4-11-2 record against NFL teams from 1921 to 1923. And after posting a 0 wins and 6 losses record in 1924, Dunn was forced to fold the team. He just couldn't get people to come and be interested in a winless team. It didn't get much better for the franchises. They went 1-9 in 1924 and took a beating in 1925, as they were also having trouble finding opponents. So they had to play the powerful Chicago Bears 3 times. Now, Dunn and Val Ness, they still had to dream of running a pro football squad, so they reformed the squad in 1929-1930 seasons, rebranded under the name of the Minneapolis Red Jackets. And the organization was bleeding money from dismal attendance even then. And after a 1-7-1 start in 1930, the Red Jackets were basically merged into the National Football League's Frankfurt Yellow Jackets organization when they sold Frankfurt 10 of their Red Jackets players and just went out of existence. 3 other players were sold to the Green Bay Packers just to try to get some extra cash to pay off the debt the team had accrued over that time of 1929-1930. So that's sort of the course that the team took, and maybe you can take us back to that pre-World War I. You know, World War I hit, and then I think that sort of disbanded that group that was playing together. So I guess we come back after World War I, and they reassembled with some of those names that you have there for those later teams. And I know you have some of those you'd like to share with us.
Okay, so this is from 1921. This Oscar Christensen, who's 5'10 and 186, he was 22. It says he didn't even go to college, but on here it doesn't even have his position. So I would assume that he would have played maybe on the offensive line, or maybe like on the defensive line at 186 or 185, 175, 170. That seems really big at that time.
Yeah, you get into the 1920s. Now you're up, you know, the APFA, the NFL starts 1920. So you have a bunch of professional league, semi-pro leagues, and you have sort of the NFL, the very first real organized league known as the American Professional Football Association, APFA.
So one of the guys that I'm kind of pinpointing here, that even though it doesn't have a position, I'm just thinking talking about how good that they could have been, like this guy here, Ben Dvorak, who's 26 out of the University of Minnesota. That would be one guy that I could foresee maybe being a running back or a fullback of some sort and one of the better guys on the team. Let's see. I'm also looking at Harry Gunderson, who was 34 at the time, played for the University of Iowa, 6'2", 203.
That's a pretty big fella for back then. So that's a good size lineman there.
Right. So now here's the lineup for the 1924 Minneapolis Marines. And right away, I see that their team record was 0-6. But if, you know, if they were just really getting going, you know, in the NFL, they probably, I mean, they're all really good and talented.
Yeah. Well, you go back into what Jim Quirk's findings were in that Coffin Corner article. And he's saying, you know, really in the APFA and early NFL, they didn't have good records, but their records were like 1-3, 1-3, 2-5-2, 0-6 in 1924. But Quirk says, but the NFL record of the Marines gives a misleading picture of the team's true standing among the earliest pro football teams, because it was sort of the pre-APFA NFL years the Marines really reached their peak as a team. So it was sort of World War One sort of disrupt. I don't know if they maybe had some fellas pass overseas in Europe or what, and they were, or maybe they weren't able to play. Maybe the age caught up with them. You know, Father Time wins all battles. But he's saying, you know, they were a good team, but it's just that competition level that they jumped up into in that APFA going against, you know, some of those traditional powers from Ohio. You know, when you have, you know, Canton and Portsmouth and some of those squads down there, that really probably an awakening to them coming in there. You know, even, you know, the Rock Islands of the league in that time. So there's some pretty good teams that played in there. There was some really good athletes, you know, like Jim Thorpe, who was even a little older at the time, but an experienced player.
Right. And just looking at this 1924 roster here, where Joe Brandy coached the team. I mean, you look at games played 5-6, 4-5, 6, only two for one guy, but yeah, I mean, you can tell that there's a lot of veterans in it. So it makes sense that it's unfortunate the team lost all their games that season, but with the level of competition being a lot better than what they were used to in just the city, you know, winning 6 city championships in the first 20 years. I mean, it kind of makes sense that you're going to a higher level. You're not going to be as good as everybody else, because you're coming from a lower competition to a much better competition.
That's very, very true. You know, they if you even look at some of their points for and points against, they're really not that bad. You know, 1921, their overall record was 3-4. So they played some non-APFA games. So the 3-4 overall record, APFA, they're 1-3. But even in the APFA being 1-3, they had 37 points for, 41 against. So they're only 4 point points in their point differential there. 1922, just in the NFL, they were 21 points in their point differential. So not a big wide margin. I think that's why he's saying they were pretty good. 1920, they got beat up pretty good. They had a 70. Well, I guess they weren't in the APFA yet. They outscored their opponents 74-3. So it just shows you that just that competition level. But it sounds like they were very competitive, because their point differentials were not that much different from their opponents. So it must have been some close games they were losing.
Yeah, and that makes sense. So even when I just look at the Vikings now, to me, their history of winning a lot of games but losing a lot of close games even goes back to this team. So, you know, it kind of all makes sense in a roundabout way, that even though you may have come from a lesser league or lesser competition league to a better competition league, and you're still competing, you're still right there, And then you flash forward to 1960 or 1961 when the actual Minnesota Vikings got started, and how in their first season they were 3-6. They were 2-12 or something like that. Now I'm just trying to do this off the top of my head. Their history always shows that they're right there within the competition. It's just, they're always one guy or maybe two guys away from getting to that next championship level.
Yeah, that's true. That's breaks the hearts of fans there sometimes, but sometimes you just got to have a little bit of patience and things will pay off, just like they did for the Vikings. It sounds like Minneapolis had some great years right before World War II. There, everything was coming together for them. And unfortunately, a major world event sort of spoiled that their progression, I guess, into pro, from semi-pros up into the pros. And, maybe hurt their competition level just a little bit. Now, you said, okay, they turned into the Red Jackets later in the 1920s, and then they sort of had more financial woes and then disbanded. Is that what you were saying earlier?
Well, they went to the Minneapolis Marines played their last season in 1924, 1925. And then all of a sudden they disbanded because they didn't have any money because they're not getting fans. And so then they didn't start up again until Ole Hegsrud actually bought the team, the franchise, for $1 in 1929. But that was his only season that he was the owner of. In those middle 20s, when the NFL was kind of like, well, I think I said it in my Red Grange episode that a lot of these teams were popping up like weeds, but they were also dropping like flies, because there was just so many coming and going because of the financial must have been hardship at that time, where college football was really expanding. Everybody wanted to go to a college football game, not necessarily a pro football game. So I think that's why Red Grange blew up the way that he did in 1925. When he said, oh, I'm going to sign with the Chicago Bears. And then when Ernie Nevers, who was from Stanford, an All-American at Stanford, signed with the Duluth Eskimos or the Duluth Kellys, that kind of also made things blow up in the NFL there at that time.
Yeah, well, you also had 1929, 1930 when the Red Jackets were playing. You also had the Great Depression hit. So folks just didn't have the money because there was quite a high unemployment and people lost fortunes in one sweeping day there in 1929. So that probably had some effect too. The economy was just very poor in the United States and around the world.
Right.
Now, you're not saying did the Red Jackets didn't end up turning into the Duluth Kellys. They sort of ended, or they were maybe playing the same time possibly.
Yeah, that's correct. The Red Jackets were just a one season and done kind of thing, because I think it was just that Ole Hegsrud, he wanted it to work, but it just didn't. He just couldn't get people to come in and watch. And yeah, you're probably right, too, with the stock market crash in 1930. That probably had a lot to do with it, too, where nobody had any money. And that's probably what did them in, too.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. It did a lot of these early pro teams. You hear a lot of them ending there in the late 20s, early 30s because of financial hardships. And, you know, the NFL is, it started off in these small towns, but really there's only one of those smaller markets that survived, and that's Green Bay, and all the rest of them, sort of went to the bigger cities, Decatur went and going to Chicago and having success. The team sprung up in New York and Philadelphia and places like that, where they survived in the smaller towns, Canton, and even Massillon was never in the NFL or APFA, but they couldn't play with those larger cities, because it was just the fan draw, and that's where the revenue was the gate. So that's how teams made their money. unlike today, where it's probably more based on the television contracts that they're getting. They're in the billions of dollars. Our friends up north are having that problem in the CFL. Their revenue is based on what they take in at the gate at stadium, and they don't have the gigantic television contracts that the NFL does. And I think that's why they're always sort of in financial woes. So interesting.
Okay, yeah, makes sense for sure.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, I thank you. That's a pretty nice history of the Minneapolis Marines and the Red Jackets. And sorry it ended so abruptly for them with the financial woes. But why don't you tell us, what do you have coming up on the Pigskin Tales podcast that we can look forward to?
Well, the next part of the Red Grange story includes his time with the Chicago Bears. And also, I'm going to be talking a little bit about Cash and Carry Pyle, his Red Grange's agent, and how he basically, in a roundabout way, when Red Grange frequented the Virginia movie theater, or the Virginia Theater, I think that's what it was called then. That's when Cash and Carry Pyle, or CC, I guess a lot of people called him that. He just started becoming friends with Grange. And then he asked him one day, he's like, how would you like to make $1 million? How would you like to make $100,000? Yeah. How would you like to make $100,000? And I suppose Red Grange looked at him curiously and said, like, well, I suppose it'd be pretty awesome. You know, thinking 1925, $100,000, a lot of money.
Yeah.
So.
Most definitely. That's a pretty cool story. So, yeah, so we're anxious to hear that. And I'll tell you what, we appreciate you coming on here today and talking about some football history with us, and preserving that football history and preserving the football history on your podcast, The Pigskin Tales. Everybody can find that on sportshistorynetwork.com, Pigskin Tales, and your favorite podcast provider. Just look it up and follow him on there. I don't think they call it subscribe anymore. They call it following. So yeah, that's very interesting. I listen to you each and every week here. So we appreciate you preserving the football history and joining us today, Ross. And thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
We're taking a peek over at the chains and the down marker. It's fourth and long. We're going to have to punt the ball and get on out of here, but we'll have another series tomorrow for your football history headlines. So be sure to tune in. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast. PigskinDispatch.com is a proud affiliate of the Sports History Network, the headquarters of sports yesteryear.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.